We're continuing tonight with the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, and the section that we're considering here is very similar, at least it follows the same pattern, as the section that we considered yesterday. We entitled the class yesterday, The Two Kinds of Righteousness, and that might even carry over into our class this evening. If you want another title for this class, we could take it from the last verse of the chapter, Be Ye Therefore Perfect, so that at least for part of the class we'll be discussing what Jesus meant when he spoke of the perfection that we should show as his disciples. So let me just recapitulate a bit what we discussed yesterday by way of the two kinds of righteousness, because we're moving, as I said, through the same area. The two kinds of righteousness are the righteousness that the Pharisees exemplified and that which Jesus taught. And they were two very different kinds of righteousness. The Pharisees were interested in the technicalities and the details of the law. They were interested in comparing themselves with one another, in looking down upon others who hadn't quite fulfilled the same requirements that they had. And they were interested in the actions and not particularly in the heart or in the mind from whence those actions would develop. So as long, according to the Pharisees, as long as the actions were controlled, therefore a person could be righteous without any particular regard to what he thought or what he desired. The righteousness that Jesus was teaching when he said, your righteousness should exceed that of the Pharisees, had to be righteousness of a completely different sort. Righteousness that was interested in the heart as well as the actions, that wasn't particularly concerned with details, but rather was looking for the principles that God was trying to instill in individuals through the teaching of his law. And also the righteousness that Jesus spoke of, that he was instructing his disciples in, was a righteousness that did not sit in judgment of anyone else, that did not compare one person or his actions with another person and his actions, but rather was willing to be merciful, was willing to forgive, even as Jesus said in the Beatitudes, blessed are the merciful. So you see there are two very distinct kinds of righteousness, and they are shown here in this chapter 5 by the sorts of introductions that Jesus gives to them. Throughout this chapter, beginning with about verse 19 or 20, we see that Jesus is giving continual contrasts. You have heard it said by them of old time, and then he gives the Pharisees' version of righteousness, but I say unto you, and then he gives his version of righteousness, the two being contrasted with one another. So we'll look this evening at several more of those contrasts that will bring us to the end of chapter 5. Beginning with verse 33 then. Again, Jesus says, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, some versions say to them of old time, but it's pretty much the same sense, thou shalt not forswear thyself. The RSV translates that, I think, quite reasonably, thou shalt not swear falsely, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. Now, so far as it went, this was a very plain statement of what the law had to say, that if a man desired to take an oath, he would swear by the name of God, and then he was bound by that oath without escape. Oh, there were provisions and technicalities and exceptions to various oaths that were taken, but generally speaking, that is what the law did in fact say. Jesus goes a step beyond this. And he introduces it in verse 34 by that formula statement, but I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy own head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yes, yes, or no, no. I'm giving the modern English equivalents there without confusing you with the King James. Yes, yes, or no, no. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil, or whatsoever is more than these, arises out of false motives. What do we mean by that? Harry Whitaker, in commenting on these verses, said the following. Moses' command, and it's taken from Deuteronomy 10 and verse 20, thou shalt swear by his name. Moses' command, Brother Whitaker said, was ruthlessly interpreted as meaning that any other oath not addressed directly to God himself need not be regarded as binding. This was a fine device in the hands of the Pharisees for deceit or deception in a business deal. So you see the point of what the Pharisees were doing. They were taking a law which said, if you swear, you should swear by the name of God. And they were saying, if we swear by anything else, then we don't have to be held to that, because the law strictly says only that if a man swears by God's name or in God's name, only then is he bound to keep his oath or keep his word. So you see, the Pharisees were looking at a very strict and very narrow law, and they were saying it only has application in this one very small area. So if we step just over the border, if we use a different name, if we swear perhaps by Jerusalem, or swear by ourselves or our own heads, we're not bound to keep that kind of an oath, because it isn't swearing in the name of God. So you see, by making a very narrow and limited application of Moses' law, they were in a sense setting themselves free to do whatever else they pleased if they stepped just over to the other side. And in a very deceitful way then, a very clever way perhaps, but a very deceitful way, they were getting around the intent of the law so that they might, in a sense, come very close to lying, if not lying altogether. Jesus says, in effect, don't try to make the law as narrow as possible, but take the intention that God evidently had behind the law, the intention of exhorting you to be honest in all your dealings, and therefore understand that the spirit of the law intends that you be honest no matter what you say or how you say it. Hence Jesus then says, do not swear at all, because apparently among the Jews and the Arabs and other people in the Middle East in those days, and I think it's even true today, you go into a marketplace, or you find two men who are attempting to conduct a business deal, and they're making all kinds of promises back and forth, swearing by this or that, but avoiding swearing by the name of God, so that those things that they are saying with every pretense of being perfectly honest may or may not be true. And you know the statement, let the buyer beware, is thousands of years old. That is the way that the Jews and the Arabs quite often conducted their business deals. For that matter, you go into most used car lots today and you'll find people conducting business deals in the very same way. Making all kinds of promises, but don't expect them to put their name on a piece of paper and swear to it, in a sense. Those promises mean nothing. Jesus says, don't get involved in this. There are a number of proverbs in the book of Proverbs that talk about the buyer and the seller, the ones who make great promises and yet they mean nothing. And so much of commerce, of salesmanship, even in our modern world, is conducted on some of those same principles. Don't believe everything you hear. Don't believe everything you read. Don't believe everything they tell you on television. It's amusing. Adam watches commercials sometimes, and he'll come in and he'll say, you know that such and such detergent is the best by far, and it's twice as good as so-and-so. And Barbara says, don't believe it. But that's the way things are. If you want to get someone's attention, you have to make almost outrageous promises, and then they take those promises and cut them in half or divide it by two-thirds and come up with more or less a reasonable approximation of the truth. Jesus says, don't get involved in that. Don't start making promises. Don't try to evade the law of God that says you should be honest. Simply be honest. Say what is true. Don't even make a pretense of promising that it's true or swearing by something. And of course, we don't generally swear in that sense in any regard, but the same principle is there. I mean, what he's saying is this. Two people are having a conversation, and each one presumably is saying the truth to the other. But then in the middle of the conversation, one of the persons says, oh, but this is really true. You know, what do you immediately think? You immediately think, what about all the other things you just finished saying? Jesus says, don't even think about different levels of truth. One brother I knew used to tell stories, and he would start out some stories by saying, I'm telling this for the truth. I'm telling this for the truth. Everything you say should be true. There should be not some statements that are 75% true and others that are 90% true. They should be true. There are some people who go about denying certain things, but denying them in a very careful way. If you remember a few years ago, if you watched the Watergate trials and all the interviews and so forth, you had a whole string of politicians and clerks and various government officials who went about continuously before Congress or before the courts categorically denying this or that or the other. And you listen to them, you think every one of them is perfectly honest. Until you realize that if a person says, I categorically deny that on the evening of June the 17th, I was doing such and such of an illegal sort of activity, that categorical denial really means that I was probably doing it on the 18th or the 16th, but I categorically deny beyond any question that I was doing it on the 17th. And therefore, a statement which appears to be true, and is true maybe in a very narrow technical sense, is essentially a false statement, a lie. And all you have to do is sit in the courtroom and you see people going about lying in that particular way with the aid of clever attorneys continuously. Jesus says, don't do that. Don't even think about doing that. Don't deny something in such a way, or don't state something positively in such a way that the intent of it is to deceive someone. We probably all experienced occasions when people did that sort of thing with us, or when perhaps we were tempted to do that sort of thing to others, because sometimes it's unpleasant to tell the truth. Jesus says, tell the truth. He says in verse 37, let your communication, that's the word logos, let your word be yes, yes, no, no. What he means by that quite plainly is, if somebody asks you something, give them a yes or no answer. And if they ask you again, tell them the same thing. In other words, the second time, don't protest that you're telling the truth so vehemently that they might question it, but rather simply say yes or no, as the case may be. In other words, to confirm that what you are saying is true, say the same thing twice. But when Jesus is putting it that way, what he's saying is, don't elaborate, don't embellish, don't protest how honest you are, just say what is true. And if you're asked, say the same thing again. And therefore, you won't ever mislead people, and you will never be able to play the part of one of those super salesmen who says just enough of what's true while ignoring the other parts to make a deal or to make a sale or to work to his own advantage. Never do that, but simply be as honest as you possibly can with all men. Now, you see, the principle of this is quite obvious, and here we contrast the two kinds of righteousness. The kind of righteousness that Jesus is talking about is not that of the Pharisees. The Pharisees approach this problem of telling the truth by saying, in effect, to themselves, how much do I have to say, or how much do I have to do? By saying to themselves, how little can I possibly get away with? Or, in effect, how dishonest can I really be without technically telling a lie? Jesus says, no. When you go about to say something or to do something, your question should be, how honest can I possibly be so that there's no misunderstanding what I'm trying to say? Not what can I get away with? Jesus is saying then that there are no gradations of truth. There are no compromises. There are no legal subtleties that can get you out of a problem. Simply say what is true, and if necessary, say it again. The next contrast begins with verse 38. You have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Now, verses 40 and 41 and 42 are clearly related to that, but let's stop for just a moment and then we'll come to those verses when we've considered a bit more of verses 38 to 39. It's all one section, obviously, but we'll come to it in a moment. First of all, verse 38, ye have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now that is a direct quotation from the law of Moses. But apparently, it was being used by the Pharisees and by others as justification for seeking personal vengeance or retribution on those who have done you wrong. That man did such and such to me. It's only right that I do such and such back to him. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Though this statement is a direct quotation from the law, so far as it goes, in that kind of application, it's being taken out of context. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 21, beginning with verse 22. Exodus 21, 22. Here is just one example of a quotation that eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. There are several others scattered throughout the law, but let's read the whole context and see in what sense that phrase is used. Exodus 21 and verse 22. If men strive, if men are fighting and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if mischief follow, apparently mischief meaning if the child dies, the child that was born prematurely as a result of this strife in which the woman was involved, if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, etc. Notice, though, in verse 22, the basis on which this kind of application should be made. According as the woman's husband will lay upon her, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So apparently this expression, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, meant that, and I think it has the same meaning in every place where it's used, it meant that the judges had a set value that they placed upon the inadvertent loss of an eye, or the loss of a tooth, or the loss of a hand, or any other sort of wound. Just as, and I think probably the one is patterned after the other, just as if you read insurance policies and it has laid out for you there the compensation that the insurance company promises to pay if there is an accidental loss of an eye or loss of the use of a hand or any other calamity that is specially graded out and a value is assigned to each particular disability or loss that might occur. The key phrase in this passage is, as the judges will determine. And it isn't suggesting, at least I don't think it's suggesting, that there would be a literal punishment for something that happened inadvertently. In other words, you were involved in a fight, or maybe even by accident, and someone lost an eye. It doesn't mean that the judges are going to lay upon the guilty party the loss of an eye, literally, but rather they're going to lay a fine upon him that he might pay compensation, as the judges have determined is reasonable for that particular loss. The payment of an eye for an eye, and so forth. A very humane and a very reasonable sort of thing to do. But apparently, a precept of the law that was misused by individuals who, in a very real sense, were trying to take the law into their own hands, not waiting to see what a judge in Israel might say was correct, but going out and seeking vengeance as they saw fit on a very personal basis. Okay, back to Matthew chapter 5. Jesus, in verse 39, does not say what the law had to say. He does not say, go to the judge and get a just compensation, as we might expect him to, because that was pretty much, I think, the letter of the law. You know, be honorable and be honest and go to the law and go to the judge and settle your difficulties there. Jesus doesn't even say that. He goes even one step beyond that. Jesus says, verse 39, resist not evil, but whosoever will smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And I know that when we start into these verses, we're talking about something that is one of the most difficult principles. Not perhaps one of the most difficult principles to understand, but one of the most difficult principles to accept of anything that Jesus had to say. Jesus says, very plainly, do not seek any kind of retribution, whether it be legal or illegal means. Don't do it. What Jesus is saying here is very much what Paul has to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 1. Let's look that up and read a couple of verses, because it seems like Paul is borrowing and amplifying the teaching of Jesus in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. First Corinthians 6, verse 1. Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints? And again in verse 4. If then ye have judgments of things pertaining to this life, set them to judge who are least esteemed in the church. Or, as the RSV puts it, and perhaps this is a better rendering, I'm not sure, of verse 4, why do you lay these things before those who are least esteemed by the church? That is, why, and he puts it in the form of a question, why do you go to those outside rather than to those in the church or in the ecclesia to resolve your difficulties? This, I think, squares very much with verse 5 when he says, is it so that there is not a wise man among you? No, not one that shall be able to judge between his brethren. But brother goes to law with brother, and that before the unbelievers. Now, therefore, he says, there is utterly a fault among you because you go to law one with another. Why do, and here he comes very close to quoting the words of Jesus, why do you not rather take wrong? Why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? So Paul here, I think, is amplifying the teaching of Jesus back here in Matthew chapter 5. As I said, this is one of the most difficult things for us to understand and to do of all the teachings of Jesus. It's very plain and it's very straightforward, but it can be very difficult for us. Why does Jesus give such a commandment? What possible possible good is achieved by suggesting, maybe that's too strong, maybe that's too easy a word, by commanding his disciples not to try to redress evil, not to try to protect themselves or to punish the evildoer that has done something against them. What possible good could that achieve? Perhaps if we could begin to understand that, then it might make it a little easier if we're forced to submit to some kind of ill treatment. Brother Perkis, in his book, where he discussed the Sermon on the Mount, had the following to say about this. Brother Perkis said, "The sacrifice of God's Son bore no relation to justice. The redemption of the world," Brother Perkis said, "is upon the principle of forgiveness. That, I think, provides the rationale for this kind of conduct on the part of a believer. God doesn't deal with us on the principle of justice. The law of Moses did. The law of Moses said, if a man sins, he's guilty. If a man sins in any point in the law, he's guilty of all. The law dealt with men in that way. But the law was a teacher. As Paul says in Galatians 4, the law was a schoolmaster to lead men to Christ, to help men to understand the need of Christ and the mercy that he could provide. So now, in Christ, with these principles of the forgiveness of sins, the mercy that God has shown to us through Christ, and the necessity for us to be merciful to others, we then come face to face with a completely different way of life. We are forced to recognize that God does not deal with us on the principle of justice. God does not demand from us a true payment for the sins that we have committed. If he did, we would all die, and that without remedy. God does not deal with us on the principle of justice, but mercy. Therefore, if we take that and then we turn around and face our fellow man, we must be prepared, because of the blessing we have received from God, not to turn around to our fellow man and say, I have a right. I demand that my rights be upheld. I demand justice. We can't. God doesn't demand justice from us. And you see, we're right back to the same principle that Jesus gave at the very beginning. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are those who are willing to forgive, because God is willing to forgive them. It's been said that every man wants mercy for himself and justice for everyone else. We have to be willing to give mercy to others if we expect to receive mercy. We have to be willing to overlook the faults of others, no matter what their character, for sins directed against us, because God is willing to overlook our faults and forgive us. We forgive people, we put up with things, we turn the other cheek, not because the person who's done something to us is righteous, not because he deserves to be forgiven, because we are not righteous at the foundation. We are not righteous underneath, truly. We do not deserve to be forgiven. And yet God forgives us. So Jesus elaborates on this principle in verse 40 when he says, if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. Notice how this is a development of what he said in verse 25. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are in the way with him, lest he deliver you to the judge, and the judge deliver you into prison. if any man threatens you or attempts to sue you at law and take away something that's rightfully yours, there's no matter. Jesus says, if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. In other words, do even more than is required of you just to make peace, just to satisfy a problem, just to be done with it. Do even more than is required of you, because God, and here again is the same rationale, because God has done more for you than you could ever have expected, more than you ever deserved. Verse 41, and whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain or two. And here is a very practical application in the days of Jesus of the sort of thing that he was talking about. Go the extra mile. And perhaps most of us know, but I'll mention it anyway, that this principle that Jesus is stating is based upon the Roman law, that any Roman official or soldier could, by law, as he walked along the highway carrying a burden, if he grew tired of the burden, he could find some poor unsuspecting fellow, Jew or otherwise, standing alongside the road, and he could conscript him like a person is conscripted into the army. He could draft him and say, here, you have no choice. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care whether you want to or not. You have no choice. Come and carry my burden for a mile along the road. He couldn't compel him to do it for 10 miles, but he could for one. Jesus says, if you're caught in that situation, don't complain, don't grumble, don't look for a way to get out of it. And instead of going 1 mile, go 2 miles. Why not? In doing these sorts of things, difficult as they might be, and we can all find application for this in our lives, in doing these sorts of things, we're not being foolish, we're not being weak, but we are demonstrating in a very practical way how meaningful the mercy of God is to us. That if God was willing to go the extra mile in coming to us, in offering to us his Son, the salvation through his Son, then surely in gratitude we should be willing to go the extra mile in a very small and mundane matter. Because after all, what are we talking about except the loss of time, the loss of face, maybe sometimes the loss of a little bit of money? What are those things anyway? What are those things compared with the salvation that God has given to us freely, without price? Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Here again, we have the same principle, but now we're talking about a situation where it might be very easy to evade one's responsibility. The Proverbs talk about, don't say to your neighbor, go and come again tomorrow, when he asks something of you, if you already have it there beside you, but give it to him today. And turn to Deuteronomy 15, which seems to be the place that Jesus is quoting from in this verse 42. Deuteronomy 15, verse 7. The law says, if there be among you a poor man of one of your brethren within any of your gates in your land which the Lord your God gives to you, you shall not harden your heart, nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide unto him, and shall surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. Beware that there be not a thought in your evil heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand. In other words, this needs maybe just a bit of explanation. In other words, at the seventh year, all debts apparently were forgiven in Israel. So a person who had money and was approached on the first year of this 7-year cycle by some poor person who said, I need to borrow $1,000 or whatever. You know, put it in terms that are meaningful to us. You know, $1,000, you kind of reach for your wallet. You know, $10 doesn't mean much, but $1,000, you want to think about it twice. So someone who is in need comes to you and says, I need $1,000. Now, in the first year of the 7-year cycle, you'd say, okay, I can do that, I have the money, and I've got 7 full years to get it back. Surely somewhere along the line, oh, so-and-so is going to come up with the money, and I'll get it back. I'll be a pretty good fellow, and I'll lend him the money, and maybe one day it'll come back to me, and pat myself on the back and feel pretty good about it. But what Jesus is saying here is, if you come to the middle of the 6th year, and you know that 6 months down the road, there's going to be the year of release of all debts, and a person comes to you and he says, I really need $1,000. I'll pay you back as best I can. And you think, and you begin to calculate and look at the calendar, and you say, well, if I give him $1,000 and he can't quite manage it, and 6 months from now, we come to the end of this calendar cycle and all the debts are forgiven as though they never existed, I'm out $1,000. And right away you go about trying to think of excuses why maybe I shouldn't do it. The law says exactly that is not the thing you're supposed to do. If you beware that there be a thought in your wicked heart saying the 7th year, the year of release is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou give him naught or nothing. And he cry unto the Lord against thee, and it be sin unto thee. Thou shalt surely give him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all thy works, and in all that thou puttest thy hand unto. And believe me, when the principles that we say are so important to us finally come to touch our pocketbook, things can get a little bit sticky. Things can get a little bit difficult. Even then, Jesus says there is a right way to act. And surely if we value that which is in our pocket more than that which should be in our hearts, then that which is in our heart will certainly be lost. God says, I have redeemed you without money and without price, as I redeemed Israel out of Egypt. No ransom was paid except the ransom of the blood of the Passover lamb. No ransom was paid for us except the blood of Christ. And it can't be measured by money. It's amazing how many of the parables of Jesus have to do with money. Of how, for example, that which is forgiven us is compared to an immense debt that is forgiven, whereas that which we forgive others is compared to a very small debt. And numerous of Jesus' parables deal with the subject of money. I suppose it's because if you start talking about money, everybody pays attention. You know, the math teacher goes about trying to get his rather thick-headed students to add columns of figures, and they can't do it until he says, well, take that 300 and put a dollar sign in front of it, and right away everybody's attention is there on the board, and they're adding and subtracting like crazy, no problem at all. You talk about money, and people pay attention. Jesus had a way of equating money with the essentials of our life and the truth. Not trying to remove money altogether from the life and the truth, but integrating the two. And it's, I think, for the reason that he says in Matthew chapter 6, we'll come to that a bit more, I think, tomorrow when we talk about Matthew 6, where he says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And let's face it, to some extent, all of us have our hearts where our earthly treasure is. We spend a lot more time looking in our bank book than we do looking in Elvis, Israel, and Eureka, or maybe even looking in our Bibles. I mean, we have to. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And so, Jesus takes money, which is at the center of our lives. And you can't do anything without money. And he ties it up with the gospel. And he forces us to look at not just the way we live, but what we do with the money that we have. Because that's a very important part of living. And it can't be divorced from the truth. We need to think about what our money means to us. And when I say money, I don't mean just the stuff that you carry in your pockets. You know that. I mean the life insurance and the certificates of deposit and the investments in real estate and homes and whatever. All of the things that can be turned into money. All of the things that come under the category of treasures in this life. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. A man can be a very fine disciple until he's forced to bring his money into the equation. And then right away we have all kinds of difficulties. And here, as in everything, none of us have any business judging someone else or their motives. The only business we have is exploring our own hearts. And that's what Jesus says. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. We'll talk about that more tomorrow in Matthew chapter 6. In this section that we just covered, we have talked about nonviolence as a general principle that was taught by Jesus. And now, before we move to the final section, I think we need to mention that those things that Jesus taught, he lived by perfectly. He was the one perfect example for everything he had to say. Notice Peter's comments in 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter 2, and we might begin with verse 19. For this, Peter says, is thankworthy. In other words, this is a good thing. This is a gracious or a kind thing. If a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully, not resisting, not fighting back, not saying, I have rights and I'm going to stand up for those rights, but suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when you be buffeted for your faults you take it patiently and say, I had it coming, so big deal. But if when you do well and you suffer for that and you take it patiently, this is acceptable unto God. I mean, any man can take it well if he's being punished for his faults. But if he is receiving something that he doesn't deserve and he still takes it acceptably and patiently and forgivingly, then that is an acceptable thing with God. And Peter goes beyond that then in verse 21. For even, he says, hereunto were ye called. Called? Yes, called by Christ. Because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. Who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. And it wasn't easy, was it? Because he was reviled. And when he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not. He committed himself to him that judgeth righteously, who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, being dead to sins, should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes ye were healed. If Jesus had not been perfect, if Jesus had not been without sin, all of his sufferings would have been to no avail. Jesus had to be without sin, and he had to suffer so that we might be provided with a perfect sacrifice for the covering of our sins. And so right at the very heart of the gospel, there is the development of this principle that a man should suffer for things that he is not guilty of. even as Jesus suffered. If Jesus had not been willing to suffer in that way, there would be no salvation for any of us. And so it is not a secondary matter. This matter of nonviolence, non-resistance to evil, submission to wickedness, is not a secondary matter. It's not some little side issue that you can put over here and you can say, this is something that maybe I'll do and maybe I won't, but the gospel is over here and the gospel is important. No. Because if Jesus hadn't lived in that way, there would be no gospel. And so we are called upon by his example to live in the very same way. Forgiving, being patient, accepting wrong, wanting to resist, and yet refusing to resist because we're following the example of Jesus. It is directly intertwined with the gospel. No secondary issue, no side issue. It's there, and it's meaningful. There are other passages we could look at, but I think probably we've belabored that enough. Passages that speak of Jesus very plainly, the way in which he lived, the way in which he resisted not evil, but I think it's summarized quite well by what Peter has to say there. And notice, while we're in 1 Peter chapter 2, notice some of the earlier verses that led into this statement of what Jesus did. Notice that he's counseling believers to show by their good works, that's in verse 12, that they are followers of Christ, to submit themselves to every ordinance of man. Don't resist. Don't try to evade the law. But go the extra mile. That's the point. Submit yourself to every ordinance of men, for it is the will of God. Verse 15. And then in verse 16 he says, you are free, but do not use your liberty as a cloak of maliciousness. And we're right back to talking about that sort of thing that we mentioned a little earlier about the brother comes to you and he says, I need a loan. And we right away we begin calculating whether or not we can do it, whether or not we're going to get the money back. We may be free to do as we please. We may have a liberty to say yes or no, but don't use that liberty as a cloak for your own greed. Because remember what God gave, what Christ gave for you. Therefore, all of these things of our conduct, governing our conduct, have a direct relationship to the gospel. We can't put these two things in two separate compartments. They're all interrelated. Just a few moments on the last couple of verses of Matthew 5. The final contrast between the two kinds of righteousness, beginning with verse 43. You have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy, which is very much a perversion of what the law said. It was a paraphrase, and it was a very mixed up application of what the law had to say. Jesus sets it right in verse 44. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Remember verses 10 through 12. Blessed are ye when men shall persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake, that ye may be the children of your Father who is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. God treats all men equally, without regard to merit. He doesn't pour rain upon those who deserve it and withhold it from others, but he's merciful to all. And so Jesus says, we should be merciful to all too. That first phrase in verse 45, we notice, do these things, Jesus says, difficult as they might be, do them so that you will be the children of your Father which is in heaven, because that is the way in which he behaves. There is a family likeness in the family of God. Jesus showed forth the character and the quality of his Father in heaven. And if we're going to be a part of that family, we have to make some effort to show forth the same qualities. Even as you have a family, a natural family, and the family members show forth the same characteristics, first of all, quite often physically, that they inherit from their parents, and then because of the situation in which they're brought up, and the teachings of the family and the environment, they begin to show the same emotional and spiritual and character traits that their parents have. So Jesus says, this is what you must do so that you will be like your Father which is in heaven. If you don't become like your Father who is in heaven, why in the world would God want you in his kingdom? Why would he want you as a member of his family? And the choice is made on the basis of how we react and how we mold ourselves by the principles that Jesus has taught. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brother only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Is it possible for us to be perfect? Should we even try? Well, we can evade that question a little bit by pointing out, and sometimes this is done, that in Greek, the word which is translated perfect means complete or mature. It means fully developed. Like the fruit on the tree, perhaps. It's there as a bud, and then it becomes fruit. The fruit is green, and then finally the fruit becomes ripe, or perfect, or complete. In that sense, perhaps we could talk about being perfect. But if you do that only, I think it's really an evasion. It's a lessening of the sort of statement that Jesus makes. And even then, it becomes, I think, practically an impossible task if we look at it only in the natural way. God says be perfect. I can't be perfect. I can't be complete. I'm a sinner. Nevertheless, Jesus concludes this long discussion of his law and the contrast between his law and that of the Pharisees with a very simple statement when he says, be ye therefore perfect. Be ye therefore complete. Even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Are complete. And when we look at the last part of that verse, the even as part of it, then there's not much room for evasion. The same thing that God is, that's what we're supposed to be. It's kind of frightening. The worst thing that we could do, though, is to look at the impossible ideal and turn away and say, I can't do that, and go in the opposite direction. Jesus doesn't want that. He didn't intend that by making the statement. Jesus knows that because of the limitations that all of us have, we're never going to come up to the ideal. But Jesus still tells us, strive for that ideal. Never be satisfied with something less. You realize, of course, when we say that, we're saying we'll never be satisfied with whatever we are, because we'll never be perfect. There'll always be something more to do. There'll always be some imperfection that needs to be removed and worked on. And that's true. So I think his statement here is not telling us to feel ashamed or embarrassed because we're not perfect. I mean, if anything could be embarrassing, it would be considering verses 40 and 41 and 42 and realizing that so often we come short and we try to find ways around fulfilling these difficult commandments. So we shouldn't be embarrassed about that. We shouldn't feel frustrated. We shouldn't feel like we want to forget about all things, these things, because we can't do it. But the point is, keep trying. So put stress upon the be in the sense of keep trying to be, and not so much upon the perfect. See, the perfect is perhaps an impossible ideal, but keep working for it nevertheless. In that regard, I'm reminded of a story that I read once of this artist, this sculptor, who was quite a craftsman, and he had been for many years. And one day he was working in his shop, working on this sculpture, this masterpiece, chipping away a little here and there, polishing the edges and so forth. And a visitor came into the workshop, and he watched the old fellow working away for a while, and it looked like a beautiful work of art. But the old gentleman was still working away, polishing here and rubbing there, and etching a little here and there, and standing back to look at the work. And the visitor finally got his attention, and he said, "Tell me, sir, how do you know when this work of art is finished?" And the old artist smiled, and he said, "It's never finished. I just keep working on it until they come and take it away." That is the way that we should approach our lives. Never will we achieve perfection. Never will we be finished, short of the kingdom, when we stand before Christ. But all we can do is what that old man did. Keep on working at it until someone comes and tells us that our work is finished.